The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Happy Friday in this Christmas season as we just move right along. Every day comes and goes like clockwork. And I guess that's the way it's been for about 4.5 billion years. It just does seem like we are having to deal with more unusual things each day than we can imagine. I've never seen a load of news, a deluge of information for the last year and a half since this whole political campaign began. We're not out of the woods yet. These are very dangerous times, as I've been saying all week, as our guests have been saying as well. Tonight we're going to talk about something that is very important and very unusual. This has to do with the amazing William Tompkins. Bill has been a guest on this program a number of times and has been involved in extraordinary acts of disclosure. Lately with documentation, original documents from the early 1950s, which refer to and allude to events going back to the teens in terms of rocketry, propulsion, and I mean advanced propulsion. All of this material is up for you to look at and listen to. All of our programs with Bill are up on the homepage, free listen, on the right-hand side under featured stories. You'll find them there. Now, there have been some people, and this is normal, who have said, well, who is Bill Tompkins? Who is Bill Tompkins really? What do we really know about him? How can we prove that his stories and his explanations and his descriptions of events are accurate? But one of the key ways to do that, of course, is to locate Bill Tompkins in the historical archive, in the records. And one gentleman has taken that job very seriously and has gone after, through the Freedom of Information Act, data on Bill Tompkins. The more we find out about Bill Tompkins in the 40s and 50s, etc., the more we know that his story is to be taken utterly seriously, which I do, and most listeners do. But this is going to be a really remarkable revelation tonight. Michael, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Bill Tompkins, an amazing person. So I'm very happy to be able to provide some of the documentation I found that substantiates what he's been saying.
We'll get to that in just a couple minutes. And for those of you who don't know who Michael Salla is, Dr. Salla is truly a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. That's the political study of the key actors, institutions, and processes associated with extraterrestrial life and its visitation or its residency here on planet Earth. So Michael is as good as they get, and he has been after this hot and heavy. When you first heard Bill Tompkins' story, what did you think of it?
Well, I was immediately aware of its importance because Dr. Robert Wood contacted me, and I know Dr. Wood very well. I've worked closely with him and his son in the past in Majestic documents and a previous book of mine, the Kennedy assassination. It's called The Kennedy's Last Stand. I looked at a number of Majestic documents and how they pertain to the Kennedy assassination. And one of the documents is called the Burned Memo, which is kind of like a smoking gun document, which proves, I believe, quite clearly that there was a directive that authorized assassination against any political official that got in the way of Majestic 12. And Dr. Wood was the one that had done the most work on this. And this was the critical document for the book that I wrote. And so I got to kind of talk to him quite closely. And and over the years, he's just demonstrated his superb knowledge of documentation. So when he told me about Bill Tompkins, I immediately realized that this was a very important person.
Yeah, indeed. I have never heard anyone, and Bill Tompkins is 93 years young, as sharp as he probably ever was, who has been through more like walking a tightrope of the most above top secret things that I've ever heard. Just an extraordinary life this man has led. And every time he's on the program, we just talk and talk and talk, and the hours go by, and we haven't even scratched the surface of so many things. He's just a remarkable man.
Yes, and the companies he's worked for and the things he experienced, he really does have a solid historical timeline of how secret space programs developed, and even up until the present moment, how this is all part of an operational program that is still ongoing.
What is your stance, and I've got to talk to Bob Wood about this next time he's on as well, but what is it that has made this possible? Is it Bill Tompkins just saying, to heck with it, I'm going to put this out there, or is he getting a kind of a passive green light to go ahead and do it? And I say that with an allusion to what you have found, which I'll get to in just a minute. But what do you think's behind this?
I think he does have tacit approval by senior Navy officials to reveal this information. In his biography, autobiography, selected by Extraterrestrials, on the back cover, he has a reference to an Admiral Hugh Webster, Vice Admiral, who basically, when Bill asked him, well, how much of the information that he had been exposed to should be revealed to the public, Admiral Webster said, tell it all, Bill. That's on the back cover. So, you know, there you have a vice admiral basically giving Bill the green light to go ahead and reveal this. And that doesn't come lightly. I mean, I've spoken in doing my kind of due diligence on Bill's testimony. I've spoken to two Navy admirals and two kind of middle-ranking officers, a captain and a commander. And I can say that, you know, three of them knew Bill directly and had very high regard for him. The fourth person was very guarded in what he knew. That's Admiral Bobby Ray Inman. He was very guarded, but nevertheless, you know, just the way he responded, I think that indicated how seriously he takes this. So I think there is a green light for him to reveal this information. And one of the things that really exemplifies this, and you are, I think, a part of this, was the search for any documentation of the key admiral involved in this, Admiral Rick Olbota. And as you know, the name was misspelt in the book. So, you know, those of us trying to authenticate that admiral existed, we were having problems doing that. And then there was a breakthrough, and I believe one of the people that was working with you and Frank Chile accidentally found on the real website.
Yeah, I found the right one. Yeah, got it spelled right.
Found the right one.
There it was. The Navy had him assigned to some strange kind of rear echelon supply and support logistics division. Was it kind of a backwaters thing? Perfect cover for someone who was in reality working at the very front edge of this whole revolutionary exposition of not just engineering and technology, but ET life. I mean, it really is a perfect cover for Admiral Batta, Batta, for your listeners.
That's right. Yes, he officially. Officially, he was the assembly and repair officer at the Naval Air Station at San Diego. He began that assignment in December of 1942 and stayed there until January of 1946. And in his job in that position, he was in charge. At the beginning, it was 5,000 personnel at the assembly and repair department there. And by the end of the war, it was 10,000. Normally, that assignment was something that a captain would run, but because of the war and because of the increased demand, I mean, the size of the base, I mean, the personnel working there and the demands increased, doubled over the course of the war. Mm-hmm. So that essentially what happened was that his position was elevated to that of a rear admiral. And he was a highly decorated officer, but quite clearly, he, in addition to his normal assignments, because he received the Legion of Merit for the work he did as the assembly and repair officer, and it's a three-page document. It's one of the documents I received through the Freedom of Information Act that quite extensive description of the duties he did at the Naval Air Station in that position as assembly and repair officer. Right. But the key is, according to Bill's testimony, was that in addition to all of that, I mean, he was running this nighttime covert operation with 29 spies based in Nazi Germany and occupied Europe, and who were reporting to the Naval Air Station and to Admiral Batta and three other captains everything that they were seeing in Nazi Germany's aerospace programs.
Incredibly high-level debriefings were going on all the time. And as you can hear in the programs with Bill Tompkins, the material and the information that was coming back from these 29 spies was astonishing. They didn't even know what to make of some of it. Flying saucers, flying discs in Germany? What? Deals with an off-planet intelligence? The reptilians?
I found it very...
just amazing.
Right, I found it fascinating that how Bill described the reaction of the Navy operatives to the admiral and the captains listening to their debriefings, that they were embarrassed almost by this kind of information, but they were encouraged to just provide the raw data.
Yes,
and no matter how ridiculous it sounded, provide the raw data. And Bill's job was, of course, to just document it all and put together these briefing packets that he would then disseminate.
And he would. He would fly them around to universities, places like Caltech, the Jet Propulsion Lab, I guess, at the time, all the major research and development contractors that worked during the war and after the war. This was some amazing material, and it remains to this day. When you went into the Freedom of Information Act, the FOIA program, to try to get data on Bill, how did you approach it? How does one do it? Most people don't know the process. Do you fill out papers and say, I'd like to have copies of anything regarding William Tompkins from 1935 to 1975 or whatever. How is it broken down? How do you know what to ask for? And if you don't ask for it right, do you not get it?
Well, I worked with an attorney, Duke Brickhouse, who is based in Virginia, and he helped me in putting together these requests for any documentation concerning Admiral Botha, because the Admiral was stopped service and is deceased. It was fairly straightforward to just make a request to get all documentation from Admiral Botha, that was something that we received, and it totaled 1,500 pages,
wow,
spanning his entire career.
Wow.
So yes, so that was a very specific request regarding Admiral Botha's military records, and we followed up in terms of any covert assignments that mm-hmm. the Admiral was involved in. Freedom of Information Act requests were put into the Office of Naval Intelligence in terms of the particular operation that was being conducted out of Naval Air Station. So far, I haven't heard back from the Office of Naval Intelligence, but we did hear back from the National Archives, who provided all of these documents from regarding Admiral Botha's service.
Were there any references to the material you have gotten so far about covert and secret and very highly classified operations that he may have been involved in? Have there been any inferences or implications here and there, maybe an unredacted sentence that is intriguing? Have you found something out that suggests that the Admiral was doing far more than resupply and so forth?
Oh, yes, definitely. There are quite a few documents that kind of have that link. The one that I found most suggestive, there are some that directly corroborate Bill's testimony about the covert program. And I've provided you with some of those, and they're on your website, I see.
Yeah.
But there are some other documents that link Admiral Botha to some of the covert operations. One of them is the Los Angeles air raid incident on February 24th and 25th, 1942,
uh-huh.
where
the Battle of Los Angeles.
There wasn't kind of like about. Yes, over Los Angeles for several hours, the Army artillery and Navy artillery just opened up against some hovering aircraft over Los Angeles. And then the next day, there were conflicting reports by the Navy and the Army secretaries. The Navy secretary basically said that was Frank Knox. He said, "Oh, it was just a false alarm." Whereas the Army secretary Stimson said that there was indeed craft up there, and that this was something that was being kind of targeted by the artillery gunners.
Yeah, kind of. I had a friend who was an air raid warden who watched that whole thing, Michael.
Right.
I got
amazing.
The first,
well, Bill
first
watched
person
it as well.
Story. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that there are a number of Majestic documents. These are leaked documents that Robert Wood has received that refer to the LA raid, and they refer to two vehicles being recovered. And this is interesting because Bill said the same. Bill said that two craft were recovered.
Yes.
From the LA air raid. And that they were taken to Wright Field, which is the premier location for the Army Air Force for doing research on experimental aircraft. So there are Majestic documents that refer to this, that two craft were shot down, two UFOs, and then these were taken to, one was recovered by the Army, one was recovered by the Navy, and we know that the Army craft was taken to Wright Field
in Ohio.
In Ohio, right. So what I found in the documents from Admiral Border was that on the very day that the LA craft had been shot down and were then the transportation process was begun to be taken to Wright Field. Commander Bolter, he was a commander at the time at the Department of Aeronautics, at the Bureau of Aeronautics for the Navy in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. He received orders to travel to, this is amazing, the synchronicity here. He received orders to travel to Wright Field.
Hmm.
On the very day that the LA craft had been retrieved and were being transported to Wright Field.
One of the craft, was recovered in the foothills east of Los Angeles and by the Army, I think. The other was fished out of the water, wasn't it, by the Navy, something like that.
That's right. Yes. Yes, the Navy got theirs out of the ocean, and the Army got theirs, I think Bill said this, the San Bernardino Mountains.
Uh-huh. Right.
But the fact that there's a document that directly links Admiral Bolter to the recovery of these flying saucers that were taken, at least one of them were taken to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio. I mean, that's a very powerful document.
That's stunning. Yes, absolutely. That's a remarkable find. You must have been overjoyed when you're getting some of this stuff.
Well, you know, I had to kind of pore over it, and eventually I realized, when I looked at the dates and matched the dates, I realized just how important this document was. At the time, Admiral Border, he was the head of the power plant division at the Bureau of Aeronautics. And so he was the one that was looking at all kinds of, he was an expert in, power designs for aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the Navy's expert in this. So he was the one that the Navy sent to Wright Field to study, exactly, to study the propulsion system of this recovered flying saucer.
This is very interesting to me.
He's the expert in that.
Yeah, he's there. He's the go-to guy on this, and they sent him right back there. Boy, wouldn't it have been amazing to be able to see what they saw? Oh, okay. My friend who has passed on was an air raid warden in Culver City, and I've told the story before, but just briefly. And she was a single lady, lived in a little house in Culver City, and got a call from her air raid warden chief. And it was middle of the night or late, and she said, "What's going on?" He said, "Get your hat on, get outside, and look up." And she said it appeared to be one object, was right above her home, up in the sky, you know, about half a mile up or whatever it was, and it was right up there. She said it was the most beautiful thing she has ever seen. The color of it, it was round. There weren't several disks. It was one object. Now, this could have been a mothership. It could have, I don't know. But she watched numerous Army Air Force planes flying in groups of three. She said three would come after it firing. Three more would come after it firing. Then they'd peel off. And all the while, the grounds around them were rumbling with the anti-aircraft batteries that were firing. And I think one of our planes was shot down by friendly fire and crashed in the El Monte area of Los Angeles and was put on a flatbed truck covered with a big tarpaulin and hauled out of there. That was one of the stories I heard. I think it's fairly well accessible. So that may have happened, but they were throwing everything they could at this object or objects that was up there. And the pictures are amazing. There's about a 5-second black and white piece of film of this that has gotten loose, and I've seen it. I don't know if you have, Michael, or not, but it appears to be quite real. And they were filming this event. It went on for some time, and a little piece of the footage, maybe 5, maybe 10 seconds, showing the anti-aircraft explosions, showing the object, Just a remarkable piece of film. Hold on, we're just running a bit late. Michael will come right back. Dr. Michael Sala is our guest this first 2 hours tonight. Be right back. And do load up the FOIA documents below. Take a look through those, and we'll go through those and talk about them as we continue. Okay, let's get right back to our special guest, Dr. Michael Sala. We're talking about Bill Tompkins, William Mills Tompkins, who will be back on this program for another conversation with more documents on the 28th. So don't miss that. It'll be a week from next Wednesday. Now, we're talking about the Freedom of Information Act and what Dr. Michael Sala has been able to find that validates and verifies Bill Tompkins, who worked, remember, in a very exclusive and classified program, so there wouldn't necessarily be a whole lot of things about him. On balance, anything you want to add about the 1942 February Battle of Los Angeles that we were talking about before we move on? What did you find out in there beside the fact that Admiral Botta was sent right back to Wright Air Force Base in Ohio, obviously, to examine this craft, and that would have been 1942. You there, Michael? Whoop, I hope we didn't lose him. Okay, let me also remind you that Michael Sala's website is exopolitics.org, and he has a brand new story up there about an alleged flash-frozen civilization in Antarctica. It's an amazing story. I can't tell you if it's true or not. There are people who are standing firmly behind it, and it would make perfect sense to me that a continent that size, it was an enormously large continent, and it wasn't full of ice at one point, would have some kind of certainly civilization. But anyway, read the article if you can. Good, there you are. Okay. Anything else you want to add about the Battle of Los Angeles, so-called 1942, and the fact that Admiral Botta was sent back to Wright Air Force Base in perfect tandem with the recovery of one of those two craft, whatever they were? Anything to add that you found in the documentation?
Well, it's a very important piece of the timeline, because what it establishes is that Admiral Botta, from that point on, became the key person that the Navy was relying on in learning about these advanced craft that had been recovered, and then subsequently in setting up an espionage program in Germany out of the Naval Air Station, that Boulder was the person expressly picked to head that assignment, using the cover of just being an assembly and repair officer.
Right. Perfect cover, as I said earlier, when I looked him up a long time ago, I said, wait a minute, this guy is just absolutely almost a non-entity in terms of getting the glory and front page news during the war. He's in the background, which is where they wanted him. The craft that went back to Wright Air Force Base, now Wright-Patterson, is probably still there, along with all kinds of other craft. And this may not have been the first recovery. There was another incident at Cape Girardeau. I've forgotten the year exactly, Michael, when they supposedly captured something that that went down.
1941.
So, yeah, it was just a year, the year before. So this was a whole new revolutionary thing, proof positive, and there may have been something even earlier than that, but we knew by 1942 that we were not alone, that this certainly the solar system, if not entire galaxy, was full of life, and it had the ability to travel great distances, and they were here. Okay, let's move forward. If you want to go look at some of the items at any time, we can all do that together, but the paper trail is what's fascinating. Did all of this come to you, by the way, in one big slug, or did it trickle out?
It was the one big slug. I mean, 1,500 pages of documents that I just had to go through to really see how relevant they were to Bill Tompkins' testimony. And the ones that I found were a few nuggets. I mean, not all of them were relevant, but those nuggets were the ones that really hit home in just confirming the key aspects of what Bill was saying.
Well, legitimizing his presence then and working for Admiral Botta at that time was really the pivotal thing that we needed, and you got it. And I really congratulate you on that.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's that, one of the first pieces of evidence or documents that Bill provided were these two chits, or these two exit passes in his book that are printed there on page 68 of his book. That's the first document there on the FOIA page. And they refer to Bill being given permission to take, you know, one and three packages respectively out of the Naval Air Station on those dates in 1944 and 43.
Yeah, they look like they look like checks from a checkbook, but they're not. If you look carefully at them, don't think they're checks. They're not. They're special passes to get through security with material at the base. This is really remarkable.
Yeah, exactly. I spoke to Dan Willis, who has worked at a number of naval facilities, and his father was stationed at a naval air station in San Diego. So he was very familiar with these exit passes. He calls them chits. And basically, he helped me identify the key elements in these two exit passes so that I could then go about determining exactly what it was that was in these two exit passes that I could confirm through the BOTA documents that I received.
Let's look at these two items now. I think everyone's on them. Go to the FOIA link and click that open. And there are two, they look like checks, but they're not. Number 76, U.S. Naval Air Station, San Diego, California, April 17th, 1944. Tompkins, WM, with one package, the private property of himself. And what's it read from there?
What it reads from there, it says, for issue of non-combat airplane. And that's very significant. I mean, and I just highlighted that in the second document there, where it actually just shows that it was a misspelling of just for issue of non-combat airplane. In other words, he was given permission to take an airplane out of the Naval Air Station. Now, this is one of the things that really kind of lends a lot of credibility to Bill's testimony, because officially Bill at the time was a second-class machinist mate.
Yeah.
And one of the documents that Bill has given us, it's not in his book, but he, in going through his documentation at his home and in his storage, we're able to find one of the documents which is essentially the document that was issued just before he was discharged from the Navy in 1946, and it refers to his class. He was officially a machinist mate, second class, and the duty of a machinist mate is to just repair aircraft engines, propellers, fuel systems, brakes, hydraulic systems, starters, and so forth, and operating machine shop tools. So those are the official duties of a aviation machinist mate, and that's part of the official Navy's description for someone with that rank. So that was how he finished his career in the Navy. Now, no mention of him being a pilot, that flying an aircraft was outside of his normal duties. So this document actually is very important, because it really is saying that in addition to his normal duties as a machinist mate second class, that he was also expected to fly planes, that planes were assigned to him for a particular mission. And these exit passes show that he was issued a plane on that particular date of April 17, 1944 to carry one briefing package to a particular location. So this is important documentation that corroborates a key element in Bill's story. That fly planes to locations that he was commanded to go to.
Yes, he told us a number of stories about him flying these packets of information around to many locations. So apparently there probably are quite a few of these chits, or there were, back in the day.
Exactly. So he was given these every time he flew that plane to deliver one of these briefing packets, whether it was to Caltech over at China Lake or whether it was to Lockheed at Burbank or Douglas at Santa Monica. I mean, he was given authorization to take a plane so he could deliver these packages from San Diego, and he was trained to be a pilot, which is he's also got the documentation showing that he was indeed trained to be a pilot. And this has nothing to do with being a second-class machinist mate. Quite clearly, he was doing something else for the Navy.
Indeed. Well, it's just like Admiral Rico Botta being allegedly charged with one kind of very important work, but nothing to do at all with his real secret assignments. You can see these two chits. They were basically, I guess, passes to give him permission to use these planes. Here it is. You got your pass. There's your plane. Go do it. Fascinating.
Well, that's right. That's right. He had to carry briefing packets out of there and also use a plane. And so, these chits really substantiate that. Two of the signatures at the very bottom, the way that these were explained, is you have a signature of the original authorizing officer. So that's marked with the red highlight there in the second document you have.
Yes.
We don't know who that is, but that was the person who would give the initial authorization that Bill Tompkins could carry a package or could fly a plane. And then you had the signature of the final authorizing officer. And this is where it becomes the link with Admiral Botta becomes very, very important, because this is the person who ran the assembly and repair division out of Naval Air Station San Diego. And he's signing an exit pass for someone who was a second class machinist mate, who could take packages and take an airplane. I mean, that's straight away tells you something very important.
Indeed. Now I see BOTTA at the bottom of that chit number 76 on the lower left, signature of final authorizing officer. There are two. So Botta's name was there. Then there was someone else who signed over it. Is that what we're seeing?
There was something.
Or
down
is that all that Rico Botta only? It looks like there's another set of initials or something below Rico Botta on the bottom of that chit.
Right. Yes. Not exactly sure what that signifies. It's something, there may be just an initials there, but I was never able to kind of determine that.
Maybe somebody just countersigned it off. So Rico Botta signed these.
Maybe
somebody just signed off again after this was presented. Who knows? Hard to say. But these were what Bill Tompkins described his duties included. Getting a plane, flying the plane with special parcels, usually information, possibly pictures, certainly lots of typed and printed material, to these extremely high-tech and advanced R&D facilities, wherever they may have been. He was He was not only involved in the debriefing, he was there, but he was trusted to take this data and fly it to where it needed to go. And that was always just a fascinating thing to imagine. What a life he had.
Mm-hmm. Well, a fascinating mission he had there. So with these documents, these were in Bill's book, and just kind of understanding the significance of different parts of the document is very helpful in understanding what he was doing. But the key was, you know, do we have independent corroboration that these documents were genuine? This is the thing that the FOIA request was critical in giving an answer to, that through the FOIA documents, I was able to get the signature of Admiral Botha. Because the thing is, there were no documents available of Admiral Botha on the internet at all. And so Admiral Botha's signature is not something that was available at all. So
now that's very interesting.
The FOIA document.
Yeah, good job on that.
Right. So what we have here is, you see, the third document is a picture of Admiral Botha when he was a lieutenant commander in 1934. And I have like a dozen other documents with the similar kind of signature. But basically, you see the signature of Admiral Botha. Now, the important thing here is that this signature has not ever before been publicly released. Huh. We haven't seen it anywhere. Mm-hmm. So this was... When we match that with the exit passes that Bill Tompkins provide, and that's the fourth document there, you see a perfect match.
Yeah, really good, very well done. I want to commend you on this because you've made it very simple for all of us to look at, and his signature is, that's it, no doubt.
Right. It's like that is the person that was signing off on those documents that Bill put in his book. So, you know, this confirms, you know, that Bill not only had that those exit passes were authentic, but also that Admiral Botha was part of this covert program that Bill Tompkins was a part of, because, you know, there's no way a machinist mate would be given permission take briefing packets or take unknown packets off a base with an aircraft and be authorized by the commander of that division, the assembly and repair division, without there being something covert.
Yeah. Here, kid, fly this little parcel up to Caltech, will you? No, this was very high level. For the Admiral himself to sign off on that in and of itself is extraordinary. And given the rank that Bill Tompkins had back then, it just fleshes the whole thing out in a very extraordinary and very vivid way. So these are really important. Go ahead.
Yes, and what it does is also kind of like substantiates Bill's story that, you know, he was kind of plucked out of obscurity straight into this position with Admiral Botha. And the thing about Bill's documents, another document that I got, this was from Bill, but it's not in his book, so it hasn't been released before. But this is a document from Rear Admiral Blakely in 1941, March of 10th of 1941. Mm-hmm. So this is the Admiral writing a letter to Bill congratulating him on the exact models that he made of the Navy's ships that had very secret gun placements and radar installed on them. And I just wanted to kind of read a sentence from that.
Please.
This is from an admiral to a 17-year-old William Tompkins at the time. It says, quote, "We of the Navy enjoyed today's visit from, quote, your fleet, for we recognize so much of your true detail copied from ships we have served in," end quote. So there you have an admiral telling a 17-year-old that his ships were so exact that the Navy admirals got to look at Bill's craftsmanship and just were astonished at how good this man was.
Right.
And so that shows that in 1941, Bill was earmarked for very important things.
Yeah.
And so just over a year later, he gets slotted into this covert program being run by Admiral Bolter.
At the highest level. This is an issue that some of you may not remember, but Bill Tompkins, as a young man, was fascinated with Navy ships, the whole idea of aircraft carriers and all the new things that were coming along. And he was able to go and look at them visually, and he got to go on an aircraft carrier once in person and walk the deck. But from his visual encounters with these ships, watching them and from going on the one, he was able to create, I guess, several dozen models. Models like a Revell model kit, but he made these himself out of his own materials, and they were so exacting that the Navy, as I remember Bill telling the story, couldn't believe that he could do such a thing, and they were kind of concerned about it getting into the wrong hands. I mean, some of this stuff was certainly classified, the technology involved, and yet Bill was able to figure it out and make it and incorporate it into the models, and these models were all put on display in I guess, a storefront window. Was it in Hollywood? I've forgotten now. And somebody saw it there, Michael, and that's what started the whole thing.
Exactly, yes. It was a Hollywood department store. The Navy learned about these highly accurate ship models, and Navy intelligence got involved, interrogated Bill's father and then Bill, and then it went up the Navy's chain of command as they realized that they had a child prodigy on their hand.
A genius.
And this is exactly the point. That's right, a genius. This is exactly the sort of person they would have needed for kind of working on some really top secret covert programs involving some very specialized aeronautical projects.
Exactly. All right, that's just remarkable. We'll be right back with more after the top of the hour break here with Dr. Michael Sala. So stick around and we will continue.